The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
BuzzFeed News shut down last month, and Vice News just recently announced bankruptcy. So what's happening out there? And what does this tell us about the future of digital media? Well, my guest today on the Michael Steele podcast has a few thoughts on that. Ben Smith is the former media columnist for The New York Times and founding editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. Before that, he was among the first reporters to adapt the tools of the internet to political journalism for the New York Observer, the New York Daily News, and of course, Politico. He is the current founder of Semaphore, a new news organization for this post-social media age of news that we find ourselves. And he's the author of the new book, which we're going to get into, Traffic, Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion in the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral. It's a great conversation. It's sort of a nice background and insider's view of the digital media platforms that drive the behavior of our politics and our politicians. Join us for this great conversation with Ben Smith right here on the Michael Steele podcast after this quick break. What up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Yes, summer is here, baby. We are ready to rock to the roll. I got the beach behind me, and I've got Ben Smith in front of me. This is great. Welcome, Ben. It's so good to have you on the podcast, man.
It's a great beach. Thank you for having me.
No, absolutely. Well, You've got a great legacy in both traditional media and non-traditional media now, and you know, particularly outside of the newspapers and TV. And you've got this great book, Traffic, that is sort of an interesting sort of way of looking at how we got here and the twists and turns that we took, some deliberate, some accidental, to wind up in this space. I love, there were two things that I, in reading some of the prep for the book and starting the book itself, but one of the things that I noted was this is a rollicking and fun, but also unnerving chronicle. And you're right. I mean, there's some really good stories in here. But when you put it all together, you begin to get a sense of some of the problems and the dangers that we need to be mindful of. So help us set up Traffic. What is it you wanted to tell in this story? And then we'll just get into the meat of it.
Yeah, for sure. And thanks for having me on, Michael. I still think of you as chairman.
It was a day job. What can I say?
And yeah, and you know, as you say, like I came up as a blogger, covered for the New York Daily News, and then for Politico, where we met, and then ran BuzzFeed for 8 years. And you know, when I was an early political blogger, before there were political bloggers, there were places like Gawker doing all sorts of other stuff, and I was copying them, and it was a world that I was interested in, was sort of importing their style and their tactics to politics.
Right.
Political reporting is pretty stodgy and newspapery. And then I get to BuzzFeed, which was really a social media sort of centric world. And in both cases, I always had the sense of, you know, if you like, when you like arrive at a scene or a party or an organization, everybody says, well, the really interesting part was right before you got here. And in fact, at BuzzFeed, like I show up wearing a suit in 2012, and it was like the interesting part ended because you got here.
Because you got it, right.
And then I had this very intense ride, you know, through all of this, and came up for
what got you through that door in the first place? Well, I mean, what got you to BuzzFeed? I mean, really, Politico was kind of mainstream at that point, right?
Well, you know, it's just, you could, I was of this sort of journalistic generation where you could just see that how fast things were changing.
Yeah.
That we were all actually communicating with each other on the internet. And, you know, when I started blogging out of New York City Hall, it was if somebody, you know, if the mayor, if Mayor Bloomberg sent out a press release or held a press conference at 11, I could attend, go to lunch, write about it at 2 p.m. And if you were one of the couple thousand people who might have cared what he said at the housing press conference, that was the only way for you to find out that it happened and what had happened for 10 more hours until the New York Times put its edition online at midnight. And so there was this huge space, just if you were a regular person on the internet or a reporter, just to do that work. And Politico kind of took those tools of blogging and kind of professionalized them and made them more formal and accelerated everything. But then I was writing this blog at Politico covering particularly Clinton, Obama, 08. And by 2011, you can feel that all that energy that's gathered around these blogs where we're making news and arguing with each other has suddenly just moved to Twitter. All the people like you, like the people you want to be reading you and you want to be emailing you have moved are over on Twitter. The crazy commenters have moved to Twitter.
Right.
Your sources have moved to Twitter. And when you write something, you're no longer saying, oh, I hope people will come type in my blog and go to it. You're saying, I hope they'll go to Twitter and that my thing will be go viral on Twitter. And so when Jonah Peretti, the founder of BuzzFeed, approached me in 2012 and said, I have this weird website that's full of like cat pictures, but really what it is a project in trying to figure out what people share on the internet.
Right.
And imagining an internet where what really people do is they don't go to your website. They go to Facebook.com. They go to Twitter.com. That was already sort of where I was living. Like I hadn't thought about it that abstractly. I hadn't thought, wow, the social media revolution is here. I'm not sure I even knew what those words meant, but it was, but it matched sort of the experience of journalists in that moment of seeing Twitter become the front page and wanting your work to spread first of all on Twitter.
Yeah, it's all about becoming viral. Caught on in a way that I don't think people really thought it would.
Yeah, and scoops, you know, scoops are very viral. And so it was very satisfying for a while, actually. And, you know, I think, and so I sort of, you know, that sort of rise and fall of that whole social media world, and I kind of came out of it in 2020, I went to the Times to write about media, and just had this question of like, what the hell just happened? And in a way, the book is an attempt to answer that for myself and to go back to all the things that I knew I had missed.
Right.
Early on and been left out of, and just to be like, what was that about? And so, I mean, that's sort of the project and where it started. I mean, I think it was like this, like everything else, these things start in tiny little scenes and tiny little worlds among people who know each other and
right.
date each other and whatever. And in the case of this generation of online media, it really was this kind of downtown Manhattan internet world where Huffington Post was started and Gawker was started and BuzzFeed was started and all the kind of big brands of the 2010s, basically.
So to answer your question, what the hell happened? Because the innocence sort of dissipated fairly quickly. I mean, you alluded to that 2011 period, 2012, 2013. We're now at the beyond the staging where you and I used to dance when I was RNC chair around, you know, the party change, the Republican Party changing for sure. And all of the various pieces that were beginning to emerge. I love the chapter that you did on Breitbart and that, because I was very much a part of that period and very much, you know, aware of what was happening there. So, but from your perspective, when you sort of step back from that closeness of it and sort of look down on it from a 360 degree perspective, what the hell happened, do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that was most surprising to me in going back, and particularly, you know, we're talking about politics because media and politics are so intertwined.
Right.
Was that the people who were first out the gate on the internet, places like Huffington Post, viewed internet media as just presumptively left-wing and progressive. you know, Howard Dean had sort of been the king of the internet, not because he was himself really anything in particular, but because he captured all this anti-war energy,
right,
all this disgust at the New York Times in particular for blowing coverage of the Iraq War. And Obama, you know, who people forget, because Obama really is not a populist, but he was the anti-war candidate. And he also sort of captured that energy,
mm-hmm,
and for lots of other reasons too. And so these, you know, the people who founded Huffington Post, and Gawker, you know, they were sort of Obama supporters, and it was just assumed that the internet was where, you know, was where Obama supporters are. If you wanted to find conservatives, you'd go to the Drudge Report or like Free Republic, if you remember that, like this kind of backwards looking website that felt like ancient history even then. And Facebook in particular was seen as left wing. Like in 2011, Barack Obama goes to visit Facebook, and not because he doesn't go there and say, I'm here because it's a Democratic Party instrument, but it's just assumed, right? It's like going to Madison, Wisconsin. Like that's where the kids are.
Of course, that's where the kids are. Yeah, we go hang out with the kids.
And in a way, the biggest, it's almost hard to remember that idea. Like, oh yeah, the internet. You know the internet where the left wingers are. Like, what? It doesn't make any sense. But that was where, and then you see this shift happen after 2012, just very, very fast,
yes,
where Breitbart in particular, but lots of other, sees that two things really. One is websites like Breitbart, led by Breitbart, take the kind of way of thinking about traffic, about looking at, okay, what do readers really want? Let's give that to them and apply it to conservative politics. And what it tells them is there are two things they want. They want stories about people who are being killed by undocumented immigrants, and they want stories about Black people committing crimes. Those are the two things that drive traffic. They have a Black crime vertical. They are all over the undocumented immigrant story. And they follow the, like, these pretty dark forces that the Republican Party has sort of like kept in check for years.
Right.
Like, and they just, like, you know, they just feed those fires because that's where the energy is. And they just follow it to its logical conclusion. And the other thing that happens is that Facebook in particular, social media, Twitter, others in general, but Facebook in particular, you know, they're not interested in who they get elected. I mean, they like Obama, but whatever. They're interested in, right now you're spending 14 minutes a day on Facebook, and they think they can get you to spend 15, or at least there's somebody's job is to get you to spend 15 and to increase your engagement. And so they're looking at these metrics and these things like, how do we increase engagement? Well, what if we take the thing that most people are looking at and we show it to more people? Like, oh, that works. But what if we take that a step further and we take the things that people are sharing, and because those must be even better, and we show that to most people. And then that kind of goes a little wrong because people are sharing like weird fake
all stories. All kinds of stuff.
Having a body double.
Yeah,
all sorts of nonsense. And I should say that in that earlier generation, Jonah Peretti, my boss, when we got to BuzzFeed, the slogan was no haters, because there was a belief that social media would bring out the best in people. That if you were in public, you know, in private, in a search engine, you might, you know, look for really dark stuff or behave in a negative way. But if you're in public, you're obviously going to be posting things that make you look like a thoughtful, generous person, not like some screaming lunatic. This did not turn out to be.
Well, and that's because the platforms allowed you to hide your true self. So,
you know, people think that, but that is not the case. Facebook is real name, and people behave just as badly with their real identities, it turns out. Is not,
yeah,
what you
do. Fair point. Fair point. Because I was thinking mostly on the Twitter side of it.
Yes.
Yeah, I got off of Facebook because it was too batshit crazy for me. It just, I was just like, you people are the fucked in the head. I can't.
Yeah,
deal
and
with
that's
this
people with their real names. And so
yeah,
and Twitter, the anonymity stuff is another thread for sure. But so Facebook then says, well, okay, what if we say we're going to go beyond just sharing to make sure that we're weeding out like the weird stuff people share without reading. We're going to go to something we call meaningful social interaction. And what that means is the thing that they promote is a thing people comment on, because that's supposed to mean that like we're really having a serious conversation.
Right, right.
But of course, the thing people comment on is like, I post an offensive meme and you say, you're an asshole. And I say, no, you're stupid. And then we go on like that for a while. And the system says, wow, look at this great engagement. I'm going to show this meme to everyone on the platform.
Right. And stupid and asshole are having a conversation.
Yeah. And so that becomes, that sort of overruns Facebook. And I mean, it also, you know, people are talking about cute baby pictures, lots of other things happening. But when it comes to politics, it promotes the most divisive stuff. And it's at a moment when globally, not just in the US, there's this new kind of right-wing populism whose style is to say the most transgressive thing you can say, kind of just to show you're not part of the establishment.
Right.
To say something offensive, to say something sexist, to say something gross, to make an obnoxious joke, to show that you're an outsider. And like, you know, Trump does it, Bolsonaro does it, Duterte does it. Like, it's a style of politics.
Right.
And it sort of is perfectly suited for Facebook.
But so
the best way to engage on Facebook is to say something offensive and have people argue about it. And then the
system is that shows. Like a chicken egg argument, though? So the Trump versus, you know, grandma. So grandma's posting shit on Facebook and you're sitting there going, oh, hell, I'm not going to Thanksgiving with her since Thanksgiving because grandma got a little cray cray. Or was it Trump that sort of elevated that and gave permission for that in a way that we did not see before his arrival? Because I would submit that a lot of that was kind of on that Facebook platform happening. And it really kind of, you know, we look at Twitter and some of the other platforms that have the whole liking principle. Liking doesn't, you know, checking that heart doesn't mean I agree. In fact, some you know, people would say, you know, if I check the box, doesn't mean I agree. I just want to acknowledge this so you can see it. All of those symbols and all of those emojis kind of got confused in the sense that they kind of got wrapped up in some really negative behavior that seemed to sanitize them and to give them a level of legitimacy because I just hearted it, right? And if I hearted it, then either I subscribe to that point of view or I'm okay with what is said. It wasn't until you really got into the more visceral exchanges like you just described, you're an asshole, you know, your mama wears combat boots, you know, kind of back and forth, that you began to sort of parse through that to see exactly what people were thinking. So did you find that to be a little bit more problematic in terms of how the political leadership, whether it's a presidential candidate or even a president, versus the activists who discovered this? Because you make a very interesting point, Ben, when you talk about how this platform, these platforms, this digital platform in particular, was supposed to be or was thought to be this purview, purview for progressives, right? That this was their way of sort of getting truth out there. Conservatives looked at that same platform and said, to hell with truth, because we're not trying to promote progressive truth, right? Yeah. So you sort of began to see, at least on the back end side of this, conservatives sort of looking at the platforms a lot differently than the more traditional liberals and progressives did. And that was reflected, I think, in the people who were online and how they responded, right? Wrong? Where am I?
I mean, I think the thing you asked said before, like the chicken and the egg question, is sort of the heart of it. Like, I think when you start trying to figure out like what caused what, it's all sort of flowing together. Things right. have a lot of different causes, but it was this kind of perfect storm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense, where it all just kind of happened at the same time, right? Even though it was not necessarily connected, it just kind of happened. And they may have connected a little bit later on.
And it sort of fed on itself.
It fed on itself.
But one thing I think that people, American journalists and journalists are like just of necessity, the way the media is structured, it's national. But if you look at this particular stuff, the rise of the right, kind of of this new right,
right,
and the spread of social media, the same thing happened everywhere. It wasn't us. It wasn't Donald Trump. You had basically the Donald Trump of X country everywhere. And they didn't all win, but they all had the same kind of confrontational social media surge and the kind of poison and division on social media. And so I do think it was a feature, you know, of these platforms, also probably of people being sick of globalization and very, you know, like lots of the same stuff was happening all over the place. But I think it's kind of it's an understandable mistake to think, oh, it was like some particular thing about Donald Trump. Although also it was, but it was like a moment when people like Donald Trump were succeeding everywhere.
You in the book talk a lot about how often the most divisive or controversial posts are the ones that get the most traffic. And that sort of feeds into the viral mindset that emerges fairly quickly. And what you note is that it didn't. It's not necessarily political. I mean, it could be, you know, as you noted, an article that said, "Let's talk about how disgusting olives are." Yes. And all of a sudden, you know, you've got 100,000 people opining on olives.
Yeah.
How does posting controversial topics generally, articles and other things like that, impact digital media? And more importantly, I think, kind of drive the behavior of those who are supposedly in control of digital media, individuals like yourself, who are running the BuzzFeeds and your new project, Semaphore, which we'll get into in a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think by like 2017, and there's a, in the book, you know, I got a hold of this correspondence between Jonah and my CEO and the people at Facebook, who, and what he said specifically was that they've built this system now in which the only thing that will go, the things that go most viral specifically are things that can be misinterpreted as racist. Like there was this category of kind of like dumb joke that like stuff white people like, you know, you see like, it's like whatever. Like,
oh,
it's
don't get me started on that one, brother.
And it's like, and it's kind of like an in joke. Like it's not right. It's not like a mean joke told by non-white people to like diminish white people. It's like a stupid internet meme that like, whatever. But if you're not in on the joke and you see that, you can feel like, what the hell is this? And feel attacked. And the stuff that was going most viral was stuff that could be interpreted as racist and people could freak out about it. And like the most toxic, divisive stuff in America. And that was like the only thing that would go viral on Facebook in 2017.
Is that some of the leading indicators of cancel culture that would emerge by 2020?
Oh, that's a great question. Cancel culture was around, you know, well predated this. Sure. I mean, the first place that I really saw it, and this again was a really interesting part of the book for me, was this website Jezebel, which you and I may not have read as not being young women in the aughts, but was this like new feminist blog that kind of like ripped the cover off a bunch of like, I don't know, things that were not being talked about, like photo, like the way women were, the first thing they did is they put out a $10,000 bounty to get an unphotoshopped photo of a model from a women's magazine. And somebody stole a photo and gave it to them for the bounty. And here's this like, you know, country singer with smile lines and freckles that had been all wiped out. And also talked about life and sex and all these things in a normal language that real people talked about, not the sort of bullshit language of women's magazines.
Right.
And it was incredibly popular. It was a huge sensation, but also they had these commenters who felt so connected to the writers and to the site. And if the writers like stepped a little out of line, if they had an opinion that was seemed like off brand or controversial, their own readers would just attack them and like try to keep them in line and like tell them what it was supposed to be. And the women who worked on that sort of had like feel like they had this like early glimpse of what social media was going to be like. And I do think a lot of those same mechanisms around sort of like driving controversy and engagement certainly amplified that on social media. I don't know. I mean, I think it's in people, you know, I think it also took people a while to develop a sort of antibody and say, wait, this is like 10 people, relax also.
Yeah. Talk about your discovery in writing this book about how, particularly given what we've seen play out since the 2020 election, the strong anti-government, burn it all down kind of mindset that has evolved to, well, we can rewrite the rules and change the rules, whether it's on voting or your rights because we want to, just this sort of deconstruction of a lot of these traditional institutions and approaches to problem solving and the like, as a way of or a part of the unleashing of the darker forces that seem to permeate and that have, I would think a lot of people, myself included, would argue, have sort of taken over what we once innocently referred to as the internet, sort of this sort of vast First Amendment playground. Now the Dark Lord is someone like Elon Musk, who, you know, not even, you know, sort of overlord of the whole thing, and
yeah,
what that all looks like and how that all plays itself out.
You know, I think, I mean, it's interesting. What's the question? That's a bunch of different things. Which one of them should I answer?
Well, I think probably the main part of the question is, how much in your writing this book did you connect dots that showed the trend line to unleashing the dark forces we now see playing out?
Yeah, I guess
that along the way, no one stopped and said, wait a minute, hold up, guys.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that in retrospect, the thing that social media was best for was destroying institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those institutions kind of deserved it.
Right.
Think about the organized Democratic or Republican parties. Like, they had their problems. You think about the media, like the media that everybody
traditional media, right?
Like, it was full of shit on lots of things and deserved a challenge. And it's not like these institutions were close to perfect, but I think social media just was so relentless about exposing their flaws and sort of only showing you their flaws. These institutions. Mm-hmm. That had, you know, been used to cultivating a kind of mystique. I think like the CDC is a great example. Like, you think they never did stupid stuff or made mistakes before? Like, of course they did. But now that it's all happening in front of your eyes, it's impossible to ignore. And the sort of traditional, it's just, and I think that the, yeah. And so social media just poses huge, huge challenge and threat to institutions. And the people who were most focused on just destroying institutions were the ones who succeeded best. I mean, Steve Bannon maybe being a,
mm-hmm.
being example. And if you go back to those early days of digital media, and this was to me one of the most interesting things in the book, you know, these people, these Obama supporters in working for these websites in the aughts, sort of thought they were the ones directing history, like they were the protagonists. But then you sort of look back at that moment and, like, you know, the founder of 4chan worked out of BuzzFeed's office. Andrew Breitbart was a co-founder of Huffington Post.
Huffington, yeah.
The founder of the Proud Boys was a co-founder of Vice. You know, all sorts of people. Benny Johnson worked for me at BuzzFeed. And that list sort of goes on and on. Steve Bannon was interested in Huffington Post and came by and, like, took a look when he was a banker, look over Jonah Peretti's shoulder to understand right. how it was going. And I do think there was this line that we really didn't see toward this new right-wing politics that that was really incredibly well suited for this kind of totally unrestrained kind of anti-institutional internet. I do think you know, people's consumers' attitudes and habits changed, and I think people who thought, wow, this wide open conversation where I can scream at anyone I want is really fun, now hate it. And people are pretty alienated from the notion that algorithms are manipulating them, that And attention is shifting, I think, away and relevance, away from Facebook, away from Twitter, toward lots of different things, but certainly toward, you know, podcasts are a good example of places where you have sort of real direct engagement with a human.
Right.
And space and context and all these things that are absent from social media. And so I do think we're now in a moment where people are sort of looking for the next thing and reacting against the last 10 years.
We're talking with Ben Smith, the author of the great new book that's out, Traffic, Genius, Rivalry, and Delusion in the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit more into some of the pranks that are noted. Some of these, I guess, founding engineers of this new media were engaged in at its beginning. And then we'll also get into a little politics, because you can't do this without politics, right, Ben? You just can't have that conversation. But we're going to get into that with Ben Smith right after this.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. We are doing a deep dive into digital media and the various platforms that grew and swelled up and then just kind of went away over the last 15 or 20 years, but they have left an indelible mark on and certainly pushed the trajectory of digital media as we know it today. And one of those individuals was my guest, Ben Smith. So, Ben, I want to get into a little bit of the how this sense of going viral. I mean, and TikTok is a good example of that right now, where it's the thing. And of course, now the establishment is like, oh my God, China is controlling this. And therefore, you know, these poor little Americans are, you know, think they're just doing a dancing video when there's something more going on. But what pushes them and lessens the concern of the established order that, you know, the individual bringing you TikTok actually may be nefarious characters, is this sense that, but I'm getting the likes and, you know, I've got a million followers and I can monetize that and I can do, how much are we letting down our guard to elevate ourselves on these platforms in a way that could come back to bite us?
I mean, I guess I think there are two different things. And, you know, one is, right, this sort of influencer culture where like everybody wants to be a sort of C-list celebrity when they grow up. I mean, I do think
I wouldn't even give him C, baby, but okay. Yeah.
But I do think it's part of a big social shift. It's not just really about media and entertainment, but is about this sort of decline in trust in institutions, growing connection to individuals all over the place. And I think elements of that are really here to stay. And political parties were sort of the first to go. The other, you know, I guess I'm more skeptical of like some of the, I mean, I don't think TikTok is a force for good. And I could imagine the Chinese government using it, you know, right, to spy on Americans or do all sorts of nefarious stuff. It's, you know, lots of, like, no, there's no evidence they're actually doing that. And it is mostly a force for just like distracting stupid teenagers like my children. And I kind of think people tend to sort of mix those things. But actually, I thought the TikTok hearings were really fascinating. And maybe the most fascinating thing there was that a number of members of Congress said to the CEO of TikTok, you know, you guys have a sister app in China called Douyin. And we're told that on that app, there's like no cursing and no sex and no drugs and nothing bad. And it's all really wholesome and nobody gets hurt. And like, why can't we have that? And, you know, the obvious answer is that they live in an authoritarian state,
right,
that rules everything. And we live in a free country where dumb teenagers are allowed to do stupid shit all day if their parents let them. But it does get to this thing, I think, that like that Congress and people are finally catching on to, which is Bill Clinton in 96 famously said that, like, good luck to the Chinese in trying to control the Internet. It's like nailing Jell-O to a wall.
Right.
Just turned out to be totally false. Turns out, put your mind to it, you can regulate the Internet. And I think now, for better and for worse, a lot of American regulators are looking at China and saying like, oh, wow, like they're able to regulate the Internet. Why can't we? And I think you saw like at Utah just passed a law against underage people being able to access pornography.
Yeah.
Which is something that like no one thinks 10-year-olds should be able to look at pornography. But there is this conventional wisdom, but the like, that's just how the world works. You can't stop it. And that's crazy. Like, of course, that's not true. Of course, you can stop it. And the notion that regulating the Internet, regulating digital stuff is more complicated than regulating space travel or fisheries or nuclear weapons doesn't make any sense.
But
either.
Is the will there to really do that? I mean, that's an individual state, but that is, I mean, the Facebook.
I don't know. If you've been in politics, if you were a member of Congress, you would vote against the bill banning kids access to porn?
No.
I think it's a huge political winner and you'll see.
No, but no one's introducing that bill. That's my point.
It will. I genuinely think this is a real like coming trend.
Yeah, but then that feeds into all the other war on culture or culture war type of vibes that are out there. All of that feeds into the grooming argument that hard conservatives are making about gay and lesbian individuals. All that feeds into other. So isolated, you're absolutely right. In another era, makes perfect sense. But today, because the platform is so poisoned by the level and the kind of branding around some of these issues as part of an ongoing culture war, something like that, and put it this way, the wholesomeness of that is completely evaporated and it becomes something else that you have people suddenly going, who ordinarily would go, yeah, suddenly saying, well, why are you doing that? What is that a part of?
You know, I'm not sure if I agree with you. Like, I think there's this kind of grotesque attack on all sorts of elements of gay rights. Like, there's just this attempt to kind of like prevent pride celebrations at companies and stuff right. like that happening now. But I guess I do think at the same time, it's speaking to something where parents feel that like the world is out of their control and there are probably wholesome, normal ways for legislators to get at that without taking away other people's rights, and preventing 12-year-olds from accessing pornography is probably something that everyone can get behind. Like, I think I do think there's this shift in how the culture sees the internet and I don't know. And there are, and it can produce these very like dark social forces, but also probably constructive ones. I don't know. You're the politician. I'm just
I tend to agree with you. I mean, we're not so much in opposition as this is how I kind of navigate through a lot of these spaces, is that I devil advocate myself. You know, I'll take a view that I have and then I'll just break it down and tear it up and just make mincemeat of it. And then reconstruct it to see if it stands. And when I look at, you know, this period and what you said, I agree, where the platforming and the content it can be developed in such a way that people, moms and dads out there, for example, have these concerns. And at some point when you're looking at these hearings, you could see the evolutionary move towards some type of legislation. My question really is, so we're saying that people are going to move faster on a 10-year-old watching porn than they will on a 20-year-old shooting up a classroom of 10-year-olds. Because,
I mean, it's like they'll move faster on anything.
Right.
That on guns, right?
Right.
No, I just think it's coming from some of the same places as the insane kind of book banning anti-gay stuff. So
right. Okay. All right. So then how do you explain the current level of audience and relevancy that the New York Times, Washington Post have versus sites like BuzzFeed and Vice and others and Gawker, which have gone the way of the dodo in a very short time?
I mean, I think there's been this huge swing back toward, you know, I think people were, you know, I think this, you know, people who felt very, for a while, excited about this new wide open social media universe really hate it now. And there's been this swing back toward these traditional trusted brands, basically, and away from this chaotic internet space.
What does that say to you as someone who was an innovator of these new chaotic brands?
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a question of like, could it have gone differently? Could social media have not been the kind of positive, healthy, open version of itself and not gotten sort of sucked into this totally toxic politics if it were built a little differently? I'm not sure I know the answer to that, honestly. I mean, that's something I think about a lot. I do think like what we're trying to do now that I'm starting a new thing at Semaphore is very much to say, like, how can we take what people like about this sort of open world, which is that you're not just stuck reading one publication and one point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Take the best from all over, but do it in a way that is consistent with these older journalistic values of, you know, having a human being who is saying, hey, this is what we think is important today.
So let's talk a little bit about Semaphore, because I did want to talk about that. And that's sort of as a leading question on what it is versus what you've done before, right? Do you still find yourself obsessed with trafficking, with the traffic? Or has your focus changed with this new enterprise that sort of aligns more in the New York Times, Washington Post space that I just referred to give you that sort of mooring for a longer lifespan than you saw with some of the other?
I mean, I do think that this is a new, for everybody in this new moment when kind of Facebook and Twitter are fading out, essentially. The thing I want as the editor of Semaphore is for you to give me your email address so I can contact you directly with news and with ideas and with views from all over, not the opportunity to hit you on Twitter if something goes really big. And so I'm much more interested in the kind of gradual building of an audience of people who genuinely feel connected and are hearing directly.
So less interested in diving and rushing.
Explosive moment to moment thing. And it is a different, it feels very different. Yeah.
Have you found, how's that proving itself out so far? You got my buddy Steve Clemens over there, so I know you got a wild man in the house with him, but.
That is the truth. Yeah, I mean, you know, Steve is a great journalist who's core to our events business, and people, that's another very kind of human, real intelligence, in-person kind of journalism that I think is very sought after right now. I think people like that human touch. They're not looking for an algorithm to mediate everything for them and manipulate them. They're looking for people they can trust and connect to, and events are part of that for sure. It's been going well.
Yeah, no, that's good. No, I highly recommend it. I've been tracking and following the posts from there. I get the email in the morning. And you know, when Steve is doing something, obviously you get that announcement. But it is a different style of platforming, I think, that's why I asked the question the way I did, because it does feel a little bit more traditional. It's as if, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, the LA Times were, purely platform digital, you know, operations, as opposed to having the history of print and all of that. That's how they would feel. I mean, it's this kind of this 21st century brand that you feel could have a longer lifespan to it, as opposed to the shock and awe. Because as you've already alluded to, after a fashion, people get tired of shock and awe. They just, tell me what's happening and help me understand better what the narratives are out there, so that I can really know what the news is. And that seems to be what you're striving for now versus where how this whole thing began back in 2010.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're seeing now is, I don't think there's like a swing back to print or to watching the evening news. I think that like there's not necessarily a return to the old technologies, but to some degree, return to the old values.
Yeah. And
people are looking for digital products that capture that sense of like care being taken, a more direct connection. You kind of know who you're hearing from. And to some degree, an editor who's saying, this is our front page and this is what we think is most important, not just throwing that up in the air for people to catch and sort out themselves.
Yeah. Now, and it's an interesting space. And how I kind of connected all the dots, you know, in reading traffic, but then you wrote this great piece. I'm an Atlantic subscriber, and you wrote this great piece back in April about the dossier, the Christopher Steele dossier, which, by the way, you guys at BuzzFeed had a hand in sort of right getting well, let me tell you what you did to my life, folks, because there was not an article that went, I was in every dossier article because everyone focused on Steele, which was spelled the same way. And invariably there was called the Michael Steele dossier. I was like, no, that wasn't me. I did not do that. But you wrote this.
Oh, great... no, I'm so sorry.
Yes. Oh,
so
man.
You did great work. Actually, what I should say here is that was really great work you did on the PT.
I tried my best. I mean, you know, it was the P story that I thought needed to be shared. But I got to the point where I just started laughing. At one point, I was going to just send you a note saying just thanks and let you figure out what I meant. But
that did not occur to me. But I'm
everybody. I mean. I kid you not, from the New York Times, the Washington, I mean, reputable institutions literally wrote the Michael Steele dossier.
Your name, you were just in the news a lot and
So it was really kind of funny, but that was not the point of this. I just wanted to share that little point, that little side story. But in that article about the dossier, it was titled, "After All That, I Would Still Publish the Dossier."
That's not what people particularly want to hear. I'll give you my sort of partial defense, because I don't think it like worked out great for everybody.
Right.
But I really, I also don't think that journalists, I mean, the basic job is you try to figure out what's going on and you tell people, and you can't spend your time thinking about how are they going to take it or what's going to happen, because then there's this temptation to hide things from people.
Right.
And what was going on with the dossier, which I think, it's interesting because it's in the context of the book, which is there was this ethos on the internet. Gawker was sort of embodied it. And then I certainly came from just publish everything.
Right.
You know what? Like, don't keep things from your readers. Whatever the thing is you would say to your friend in a bar, just publish it. And there's some good things about that. A notion that you're treating your readers with respect. You're not hiding things. But also, sometimes there's a reason you're not publishing things. If some insane person sends you an email full of unverified allegations, you should not publish that. As Maria Bartiromo, I think, is recently learned.
Yes.
In the case, where she seems to have reported based on someone who was talking to the wind. But I think internet journalists, myself certainly, had a kind of a bias toward, look, all things being equal, we should publish this. And I had gotten a hold of this document and done the same thing other editors did. I sent a reporter to Moscow. I sent one to Prague, tried to figure out, like, these are tips. This is unverified. Is this real? Is this false? But as we're doing that, we're also seeing that everybody in town has it or knows about it. Harry Reid has written a letter to James Comey saying, I know you have this information. John McCain is behaving very strangely toward Donald Trump, even for him. And it's because of the dossier. And I know that. And I can't tell my reader that. And that's kind of weird. And then CNN reported that it had been briefed to two presidents, to Trump, to Obama. And not just that, but this was a document from a reliable source that said Donald Trump had been compromised by the Russians. And from my perspective, I don't really think this is that arguable. At that point, at the point you say, hey, here in my hands, I have this document that is reputable and says Donald, the president was compromised by the Russians, but I'm not going to show it to you. Like, I think there's some logic to just saying, look, we're just going to keep it secret. But I think once CNN made the decision, and it was sort of inevitable because it was a big part of the Washington conversation. It was a big part of the story of the presidency, this document.
Right.
And we were all keeping it from you. And I guess I just ultimately think if you're a teacher, if you're a construction worker, if you're a lawyer, like, I don't have some special skill that allows me to read this and you can't. And it allows me to sort of weigh that it's unverified and you can't. That's the case for publishing it. The thing about this kind of document in politics, however, is people don't really read it. People say this is a like talisman that shows that Donald Trump is a Russian spy. And that was sort of the trajectory it took. When we published it, the conventional wisdom was this was a huge attack on that. We had attacked Donald Trump and that he responded by calling BuzzFeed a failing pile of garbage. I think now people around Trump are mostly grateful that we published it because it allowed them to sort of debunk this thing that was hovering secretly over him. And people who hate Trump feel like we, by publishing it, set the bar insanely high for what, like if he's not actually like doing disgusting things in a Moscow hotel room, then nothing else is that bad. Right. And we sort of set the bar too high for malfeasance. And I think that's probably true.
Yeah, I guess my attitude about all of it is, it fills in a lot of narratives about the man, and this again speaks to the intrepid nature of journalism. which you, in my opinion, summarized in that piece at the end, where you said, I no longer, quote, I no longer think transparency means that journalists can be simple conduits for facts, obscuring our own points of view, leaving our audiences to figure it out. The best we can do, I think, is to lay our cards on the table in separate piles. Here are the facts, and here's what we think they mean, and to retain some humility about the difference between the two. That is written by someone who has some scars on his back, clearly, but also someone who understood what hardcore, groundbreaking, you know, authentic journalism should always be about. And that seems to be in an age of digital media, where it's the clicks, the likes, how quick you can turn it around. We're not a 24-hour news cycle anymore, folks. We're in a 15-minute news cycle. A lot of us out here look to guys like you, the innovators of this sport, the innovators of this tradition, to still adhere to some sort of core idea. Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts, right? Just kind of laying out the story and let the readers be consumed by it in a way in which it informs them, educates them, entertains them, whatever you want it to do, but they get to do it on their terms. You've done your job. Here are the facts, and here's what we think they mean. Now it's your turn. That's what I took away from that. Now, did I read too much into it, or am I close?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I do think that's, I mean, I guess I do think like the whole process gave me some humility in some ways.
And now, you
know, among other things about the our own ability in the media to sort of control the outcomes of what.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a great, I think, insight. Traffic is into this world that, in many respects, Ben, is still emerging. Even with the new platforms, Semaphore, that you've created, you're still sort of pushing the edges and reshaping them in this digital age. And there are a lot of lessons, obviously, that you've learned from your days at Politico and certainly your days at BuzzFeed, watching others come and go. What is the takeaway you want folks to, when they put the book down and they sit back with that bourbon in hand or their favorite adult beverage, and they go, what is that moment for you in writing this story?
I in some ways wrote a book that was a narrative rather than sort of a pat argument,
because
I feel like we're all still processing it. I mean, I think it's almost too soon to look back with clarity about what happened. I mean, I in some ways, you know, as you say, everything is still moving so fast, and in some ways the best I could do was tell the story, and I'm still trying to figure out what it meant, to be honest.
Well, it's a good story to tell. It's an important one, particularly as we get ready to head into a digital presidential race, where we're going to see, you know, individuals figure out how to refashion these tools and to utilize the space to gain advantage one over the other. And you're going to be right in the middle of that. And I think that experience coming, having come through it so far, and witnessed what we've seen, even relating to the DeSantis announcement and how he used Twitter to announce his presidential run, with someone like Elon Musk, given all that we now know and feel about Elon Musk and the Twitter platform. I still think there's got to be objective journalists out there who can tell that story cleanly and not get caught up in the excitement and the dance and the gotcha moments that are often presented on these platforms. What do you think as a final thought?
I mean, that's the goal. And I think that there's this fantasy that you can go back to the days of, like, you know, just reading this sort of reading this kind of just the facts, ma'am narrative in a newspaper where you don't really know who's writing it and you just trust it because it's the Indianapolis Star. And I think that's not really where people are anymore. And how do you get those values of saying of basically you're feeling like you can trust me, even though you know that I'm this flesh and blood human being who's right. like an idiot about a bunch of stuff and who disagrees with you on certain things. And yet I'm a professional who is able to separate his opinions and his instant dumb reactions that everybody has from trying to describe things, but will also let you in on what I actually think. I mean, that's sort of where we are at Semaphore, the tightrope we're trying to walk. But I do think that's what people want.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, again, the book is Traffic Genius, Rivalry and Delusion in the $1 billion Race to Go Viral. Ben Smith, the founder of Semaphore, former founding editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, has been our guest. Man, thank you so much for coming and sharing the book with everyone. Highly recommend people get it. If you really want to begin to appreciate these platforms and the influence that they have, the journalists who work them, read the man who was part of helping it all come together, and that's Ben Smith. Appreciate you, man.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was fun.
Oh, absolutely. Really, really good to reconnect with you. Follow Ben on Twitter, folks, at Semaphore Ben. And certainly check out the work that they're doing over at Semaphore when you get a chance to sort of get a vibe of this post-social media age of news that we're finding ourselves in, certainly as we begin this presidential cycle. So, Ben, I'd like to get you back on at some point during the campaign to sort of get your in the moment assessment of how this platform is adapting to or shaping the presidential race. So yeah. I want to get you back on that one. All right. So, folks, that does it for this conversation. This time, I really appreciate you guys so much. When you do that download thing, show us some love, and certainly keep the spirit going here for us at the Michael Steele Podcast. Until next time, be well, take care, and enjoy the summer.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.